Welcome to Whiskey Cask, cask strength conversation featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 451 for November 9th, 2013, as we complete the 8th year of Whiskey Cask. Coming up in a few minutes.
So this is one of the pallet houses here. We have 10 barrel warehouses, and that is the smell that lets you know you're alive and you're in a whiskey distillery. I absolutely love that.
80% of the whiskey Rick Murphy and his team at Alberta Distillers makes is sold in bulk to other bottlers. But the 20% they bottle at the distillery in Calgary tends to win awards. We'll tour the distillery with Rick Murphy later on, from the grain silo all the way to the bottling hall. I'll also have the calendar of events, this week's Your Voice, and in the What I'm Tasting This Week department, my unfettered tasting notes for a Highland single malt. All on this week's Whiskey Cast.
Whiskey Cast. Proudly brought to you by Redbreast. The definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Join the stillhouse at singlepotstill.com and receive an exclusive whiskey tasting journal.
Let's get started with the week's news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. First of all, there are still no new clues or arrests yet in the Pappy Van Winkle bourbon theft. If you haven't heard, someone stole approximately 65 cases of 20-year-old Pappy Van Winkle's Family Reserve bourbon from a secured warehouse at Buffalo Trace Distillery, along with 9 cases of 13-year-old Pappy Rye. The theft was discovered last month as workers at Buffalo Trace were getting ready to ship this year's release of the Pappy Van Winkle whiskeys to distributors. Franklin County Sheriff Pat Melton has said he believes the theft was an inside job, but has yet to rule out any potential suspects. While we're talking about crime, there are also no new leads in the murder of Bardstown, Kentucky police officer Jason Ellis on May 25th. Ellis was shot to death along the Bluegrass Parkway in Bardstown. Many Kentucky distillers donated items for a special auction to help Ellis's family during the Kentucky Bourbon Festival back in September, and another auction is planned for the 2014 festival to help fund college scholarships for his sons. This week, Maker's Mark released a special bottling honoring Ellis, with proceeds from the 300 bottles to go to Supporting Heroes, a group that helps the families of first responders killed in the line of duty. The bottle has black wax with a blue ribbon, and the label shows Ellis's Bardstown Police Department badge. All 300 bottles have reportedly sold out already, but you might be able to find one still in the Bardstown area. In other news, Jim Murray's 2014 Whiskey Bible will be coming out in a few weeks, but he's already announced his choice for the Whiskey of the Year. Jim picked Glenmorangie Iolanta as the best of the more than 1,100 whiskeys he tasted for the 2014 Bible. Iolanta was matured in virgin oak casks for 19 years and was the 2013 private edition release from Glenmorangie. Diageo's new whiskey warehousing complex in Fife is starting to take shape. The first two warehouses were completed this past week at the Cluny Bond facility near Kirkcaldy and will start receiving shipments soon. A total of 46 warehouses will be built at the site, with each warehouse able to hold 60,000 barrels of whiskey. It's part of Diageo's 5-year Scotch whiskey infrastructure expansion plan, expected to cost around $1.5 billion. New whiskeys out this week. Brown-Forman's Collingwood Canadian Whiskey is releasing a 21-year-old rye finished in maple barrels. The whiskey will be available in 16 U.S. states and Ontario. Earlier this year, I reported the Dalmore's new partnership with Chef Daniel Belloud. The Michelin star chef worked with Richard Patterson to create a special edition of the Dalmore for his New York City restaurants. We got word this week that the Dalmore, selected by Daniel Belloud, will now be available at whiskey specialist retailers, with about 1,000 bottles to be made available. I received a sample late this week. I'll have my tasting notes for it soon at whiskeycast.com. By the way, that's also where you can keep up with the latest whiskey news all week long.
The news is brought to you by Glenmorangie, continuing the Caskmasters project. You've helped us choose the whiskey, and you've helped us choose the name. Next, help us choose the packaging. Sign up online at glenmorangie.com.
This week's episode is a special one. It wraps up our 8th year of Whiskey Cast. The very first episode hit the web on November 12th, 2005. I'd like to thank you for being a part of the last 8 years. And as we get ready to start year number 9 this week, the future is looking bright. WhiskeyCast started back in 2005 as part of my own exploration into whiskey. It's now become our family's full-time business, as well as our passion. Last time around, I mentioned our participation in Chase Bank's Mission Main Street program to help small businesses. Chase will give 12 small businesses $250,000 each to invest in their future, and we're hoping to be one of those businesses. However, time is running out, and we need your help. We need at least 250 votes by the end of the day on Friday, November 15th, in order to make it to the next round of judging. And as of this weekend, we're still short of the goal. You'll find links for the Cask Strength Media page on the Mission Main Street website at WhiskeyCast.com and on our Facebook page. And if you go to the Mission Main Street site directly, just enter our zip code 08033 to find us. That's again 08033. Now, you can vote from anywhere in the world, but you can only vote once for us. If you've already voted, thanks. If you haven't, I hope you'll take a few minutes and cast a vote for Cask Strength Media. Our goal in this program is to help make WhiskeyCast and WhiskeyCast.com even more useful and more interactive for you. And we're looking for your ideas, as well as your feedback and your vote. It's been a while since we last conducted a survey of the WhiskeyCast community, so we're launching a new online survey this week, too. You'll find a link for the survey at WhiskeyCast.com and on our Facebook page. If you'll take a few minutes to answer some questions, we promise we'll use the information to help us come up with some new ideas and make WhiskeyCast even more useful for you. Now, each month we pick one registered WhiskeyCast.com user to receive a free exhibition print from the WhiskeyCast Photo Gallery. Jill Hill of New York City is October's winner. Congratulations, Jill. If you'd like to be eligible for the November drawing, all you have to do is register at WhiskeyCast.com. Don't forget about the holiday special in the gallery, too. There's free shipping anywhere in the world on all orders over $200. And I'm donating 20% of all sales through the end of the year to the ALS Association's Parker Beams Promise of Hope Fund. You'll find the gallery in the pub section at WhiskeyCast.com. This week's Your Voice is brought to you by Highland Park. Had a bunch of comments on last week's episode from the Bowmore on the Rockies weekend in Banff, Alberta. Danny Williamson posted this note. I was just there. Bought a 40 Creek copper pot after listening to the relevant whiskey cast just before my flight. Shame to miss the Bowmore. Beautiful part of the world. And that it is, Danny. And after I posted a photo of the whiskeys from that night on the Malt Maniacs and Friends page on Facebook, the comments ranged from incredible, epic, and just stunning to this one from Scott Mansfield. Quoting now, seriously, Mark, if it wasn't for the fact that you embody the spirit of whiskey and you've worked damned hard at this for 8 years, I'd be cursing you. Thank you, Scott. And once again, I'd like to thank Andrew Ferguson of Kensington Wine Market and Michael Vanderhayden of Lifford Wines and Spirits for inviting me to be their guest last weekend. Now, a couple of weeks ago, I read an email from Daniel Weber asking about the duty-free selections at Newark, Heathrow, and Shannon airports. His wife was heading over to the UK and Ireland on a business trip, and he was hoping to find something unusual for his collection. Newark proved to be a disappointment, but he was holding out hope for Heathrow and Shannon. I heard back from Daniel late this week. Here's what he had to say. She didn't have time at Heathrow. Her connection was too short. In Shannon, they did not have the Redbreast 21 or Rider's Tears. The only interesting choices not available in the U.S. were ones I already had. I did get an additional bottle of Yellow Spot, though. Sorry to hear that, Daniel, but at least you got some more Yellow Spot. I'm running out here. Looks like I may have to run back over to Ireland soon. We have another request for help this week. Justin Victor needs help making his Thanksgiving holiday trip a bit more interesting. Here's what he had to say. I'm once again reaching out to the WhiskeyCast community for a recommendation on the best whiskey store in the Kansas City area. I will be spending Thanksgiving in Kansas City this year and hope to find a special bottle or two to bring home. Any advice would be greatly appreciated. Well, I haven't been to Kansas City in years, but if you're familiar with the area and have some suggestions, you can post them on the Your Voice page at WhiskeyCast.com, along with anything else you'd like to share with whiskey lovers around the world. You can also email me directly. My address is comments at WhiskeyCast.com. This week's Your Voice is brought to you by Highland Park.
My name is Daryl Haldane, Global Brand Advocate for Highland Park. Go onto our website at highlandpark.co.uk and upload your photo at Inner Circle to have your face on the walls of the Highland Park Distillery.
Time now for the calendar of events brought to you as always by Laphroaig. The rest of the month is going to be just as busy as the last few weeks have been. The Scotch Malt Whiskey Society's U.S. chapter has a tasting in San Francisco on Tuesday night, and another single malt extravaganza in Long Beach, California, Friday. The International Whiskey Festival and Whiskey Live Netherlands are together this coming weekend at The Hague, along with Glasgow's Whiskey Festival at the Arches in Glasgow on Saturday. The Green Island Pub in Zeitz, Germany will have an Irish whiskey tasting and lunch on the 17th. The Astor Center in New York City has a Glengarry dinner on the 18th. Also in New York, the Museum of Jewish Heritage will hold a whiskey tasting on the 19th to benefit Laket Israel. Laphroaig's Simon Brooking hosts a whiskey dinner on the 19th at the Peacock Inn in Princeton, New Jersey. And the New Brunswick Spirits Festival will be the weekend of November 20th through the 22nd in Fredericton, Canada. Those are just a few of the 258 events right now on our searchable calendar at WhiskeyCast.com. There's bound to be one near you. The calendar of events is brought to you by Laphroaig. Take a virtual distillery tour at Laphroaig.com, and while you're there, become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Islay.
WhiskeyCast, brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. In conversation with Jerry McCarthy, stillhouse operator, Redbreast single pot still Irish whiskey.
There was a time then we brought in 12 barrels, and I was asked to, I was foreman in the warehousing at the time, and it was to be handled by no one than myself and the supervisor in question, Dennis McSweeney. And we put it together, made it up. I was told to band them, strap them, get them onto the back of a lorry. They were being shipped off up to Dublin, and they were special. And I was told it was liquid gold. It was actually Redbreast.
Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Those in the know Redbreast.
This week on WhiskeyCast In Depth, we're going to go about as in-depth into a distillery as you can get. While I was in Alberta last week for the Beaumont on the Rockies event in Banff, Andrew Ferguson of the Kensington Wine Market was able to arrange for the two of us to tour Beam's Alberta distillers in Calgary. Unless you live in or visit Canada, you've probably never been able to taste two of the distillery's most well-known official bottlings, Alberta Premium and Alberta Springs. They're available only in Canada. The 10-year-old Tangle Ridge Canadian whiskey is sold outside Canada, but 80% of the distillery's production is sold in bulk to independent bottlers who sell it around the world. Sit back and relax as Production Superintendent Rick Murphy takes us on a tour.
I fell out of university into basically a dream job. I worked for Carling O'Keefe Breweries. I've spent my entire adult life working in the beverage alcohol industry in one way or another. So 5 years with a brewery, and then since then I've been working for distilleries. I was with McInnes Distillers for a little over 2 years, and I've been with Alberta Distillers. I'm into my 32nd year now.
And how'd you wind up getting here, and how'd you wind up working it through the food chain?
Well, essentially, I was born in Calgary, and I lived here for all of my life, except for the 2 years that I worked for McInnes Distillers, and that was basically, I was looking for something different and a different challenge, so I went to work for them, and then eventually came back to Alberta, and I found the McInnes Distillery was in Saskatchewan, and I wasn't really fond of living there, so I was looking for a job back in Alberta, and I found this one, and it's been nothing but good things ever since.
Tell me about the distillery. How long has it been here, and let's go through some of the history here.
Okay, the distillery has existed on this site since 1946, and originally, if you look at this, basically what you have is a 40-acre distillery site in the middle of a large city. That doesn't make any sense, but back in 1946, if you would have looked south and east of here, you would have seen nothing but farmland. And so the idea was that they built a distillery that was going to distill a predominant crop in this area at the time, which was rye grain, into 100% rye Canadian whiskey. And so that was the reason that the distillery was founded on this site, and basically it's been here ever since.
How much do you produce and how many different brands now? Because I know you produce Alberta Premium and Alberta Springs, along with a few other brands for other folks at times too, right?
Right. So the vast majority of the business at Alberta Distillers is bulk. So we currently produce around 20 million liters absolute of alcohol per year. That's divided into various product categories. So there's whiskeys, obviously. There is vodka. We produce some soju flavorings for Japanese customers, and we also produce gin for bulk customers. But the split is basically 80% of the business is sold as bulk, and then 20% is bottled as domestic brands here in Canada.
And those would be the Alberta Premium, Alberta Springs, right?
And Alberta Pure Vodka, Banff Ice Vodka, Windsor Canadian, Dark Horse Rye Whiskey, and Tangle Ridge, a few others that are probably escaping me at this moment.
How important is the bulk business to you guys?
Well, the bulk business is actually huge. It's the biggest percentage of the business that we do here. So included in the bulk are whiskeys that we supply to our parent company, Jim Beam, that are also brands that you see here in Canada, but there's also third-party bulk that gets sold all over the world.
Such as?
Or
at least the ones you can admit to.
Yeah. We have actually Canadian whiskey that you will find that was distilled here in Calgary that is available pretty much everywhere. And things that come to mind are First Watch in South Africa, Canadian whiskey distilled right here, but it's blended here and then packaged and distributed in South Africa. Basically, there isn't any place on the planet that you can go where you won't find whiskey that was made here.
Things like Masterson's too, right? You can't admit to it, I know. There are certain non-disclosure agreements that the company signs with some of those independent producers too, right?
And certainly there's certain things that we can't talk about.
Do you still get all the rye from around here and all the grain?
All of our rye is sourced from Western Canada, and most of our grain is sourced from Western Canada. The only exception to that is sometimes, if it's advantageous, we will import American corn.
You'll stoop to importing American corn, right?
Well, I wouldn't say stoop to it. It's just that basically, originally, this distillery was built to mash and distill 100% rye grain. But we found in designing the distillery around that, we have a certain flexibility on our grain bill that allows us to basically mash and distill almost any grain type. So currently, our grain buying strategy involves finding what is available at the best possible price on a starch basis and using that for our basic whiskeys. Notwithstanding, we do have some whiskeys that we claim are 100% rye, so we buy 100% rye for those. And all of our vodkas, which we distill from wheat, because we find that it provides a smoother mouthfeel and a smoother taste.
Are you guys still pretty much the largest buyer for grains out in this area?
Well, it used to be back in the day that we were driving the rye market in Canada. And so one of the decisions that we made to change our grain buying process to accommodate other grains was basically the fact that we were driving the rye market in Western Canada. So now, rather than contract specifically with farmers to grow rye for Alberta Distillers and artificially inflate the price of it, we buy rye when it's available at the right price. We buy other grains when they're available on a price basis, notwithstanding the specific products that we make from certain grains.
Now, we're at the grain elevators now, so this is obviously where it comes in, right?
Yes. So back in the day, they designed this place with 3,400 tons of grain storage on site. Let's just step back over here. And the reason for that was that in 1946, in the early 50s, the rural roads in Alberta aren't what they are today. So What would happen is you can get spring snowstorms here that'll drop 2 feet of snow in an afternoon, and that would close roads for days and days on end. So in order to ensure that we had a consistent, steady supply of grain at the distillery, we built such a large grain storage facility. Ordinarily, you wouldn't see that in a more modern distillery. These days, what we use it for is when our grain buyer finds an opportunity in the marketplace, she will buy according to the storage that we have available, and sometimes she'll buy train loads, and if we transload train loads into trucks, then we have the ability to store it here.
And you've got train tracks nearby too, right?
Well, we do. We have two rail spurs into the plant, but they don't extend to the grain receiving area. So we do ship bulk products out by rail. I don't see any, no, there's nothing there today. But we ship bulk products out, not only in those tanker trucks there, but sea containers. There's some at the central loading station, and also by rail car on that spur there.
We're sort of weaving our way in through the, in between the truck and the loading dock here. We're now in the grain lab.
So Ken here is our grain receiver. He's another long service employee. He's been here 33 years now, I think. So what Ken does is receives the incoming loads of grain. He collects samples that we keep as retentions for traceability, so it has the load number on it, grain type. He does analysis of the grains to make sure that they conform to our specifications, and he'll reject any loads that don't. Then he stores the grain in the proper silo. And as you can see today, we've got rye, wheat, and a little bit of barley. Actually, when we go over to the distillery, we're mashing barley today, so you can see that.
I thought I could smell mashing barley when we were driving up here.
Yeah. Yeah, so today's mash bill is 100% barley. How's it going, Ken?
Good, guys. How are we?
Good. So what have we got coming in today?
We have some wheat, and there's another load of wheat right behind this guy right away. So, yeah. Just basically wheat today. Everything else, all the barley was in.
Okay. What's the most recent one here, Ken?
Right here, Rich. This wheat right here. Deborah here back.
So just came off the last truck?
Yeah. Thanks.
And as we're walking out of the office, that other truck is pulling right in now with another load of wheat. As we step off the loading dock and into the milling area.
So this is the grain cleaning area. We have two computer controlled grain screen type grain cleaners here. Basically, they're held under a vacuum, as is this entire building. That's to prevent fugitive dust emissions, because that can be a flash fire hazard in the distillery. The reason we have two is that because we use all different types of grains, this one is set up to handle larger grains like corn. That one is set up to handle smaller grains like wheat, rye, barley, triticale when we can get it, and so on and so forth.
And the triticale is actually, I know that the guys down at south at Beam have done some work with that. I know Fred Noe was involved in a signature thing that where they did a six-grain bourbon a few years ago with triticale.
Oh, okay. Yeah, triticale is basically a rye-wheat hybrid. So it has the flavor profile of rye when it's distilled into whiskey, but it yields almost as well as wheat because it has a much higher starch content.
How much of it do you wind up using?
Well, basically, when it's available, we buy it, but we don't specifically declare anything triticale in the mash bill.
Hey, interesting forklift. I've not seen one like that before.
Yeah, it's a straddle carrier, actually. It moves 26 barrels at a time, single trip.
How many barrels do you keep on site around?
Currently, we're somewhere around 500,000, just under 500,000.
And all of it's done here on site?
Yes. This is the mill room at Alberta Distillers. We've got basically a large throughput hammer mill here. It does 13 tons of grain per hour. We have a backup mill at the other end of the room that we only use if this one's out for service. And then in the middle, we have a small mill that we use to finely grind starch for our enzyme production process. This room kind of seems to be the old and the new because we have a relatively modern hammer mill. It's computer controlled, and yet this is the original construction of the distillery. The floor above us is actually polished hardwood.
And sort of looking around, you look up, you see the old plank lumber in the roof, the original walls, the original beam construction. Just a neat old room. What do you think about when you guys come around here? What's it feel like in the morning when you come in here off a cold morning? And you hear the heat, feel the heat from those mills coming off.
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that this room reminds me of is kind of the history of the place, how long the distillery has been here, and how we've also updated it and adapted it to the more modern methods of doing the business. So this is our enzyme production plant. We have three enzyme reactors here. And what we do is we produce a combination of enzymes. Basically, our primary target is glucoamylase, which takes the long chain starch molecules and breaks it into glucose units. But we also stimulate a certain amount of alpha amylase and a certain amount of xylanase. And basically what those enzymes do is help to reduce the viscosity of the mash. And in a general sort of way, the enzymes that we produce here are very similar to the action of the enzymes that are contained in malted barley. It's just that we're using a more efficient way of harvesting those enzymes from a mash that we make here.
So where other rye distillers and bourbon distillers might add a little bit of malted barley into their mash bill, you're doing it the different way with the liquid enzyme.
Yes, exactly. So this is, sorry.
Well, I've only banged my head once today.
I don't go around banging my head a lot, as you can probably tell. But anyway, so this is the fermenter room. We have 18 fermenters here. These ones are 225,000 liters. And over the years since I've been here, we've gradually been changing out these old open top style for the more modern closed ones. Generally, better performance in the closed fermenters, more cooling capacity, those sorts of things. But I'm going to miss these because I can look in there and see what's going on, and I really like that.
And you can do it in one quick walkthrough as opposed to having to open each one up, right?
Yeah, basically. So these fermenters that are in process here are 100% barley. And these are relatively young. This one's about 24 hours old.
And this thing is churning like yeah, like nothing I've seen. Yeah, like the surface of the sun, as Andrew said. I don't know if you can hear this. I'm going to hold the microphone now, see if we can pick this up. And if you've never seen a fermenter working or smelled it or felt the heat coming off of the fermenter, off the mash, as the carbon dioxide and the yeast work their magic in here, it's unbelievable. Just you stick your arm down in there and automatically just feels warm and humid and Gotta be good in here on a cold day too, right?
Oh yeah, the temperature in this room remains consistent no matter what the outdoor weather's doing. So this one here is a little older. This is about 36 hours, and you can see that the viscosity of the mash is lower and the size of the CO2 bubbles is a little smaller. Fermentation activity has gone down a little bit, so this one's progressing very naturally. And then if we look at this one over here, they're just filling this one right now. Watch out. So this has basically two mash cookers in it. The yeast is in there, and the yeast is just starting to come to life. So you can see a little skiff of foam on top. Within 12 hours, this one is going to be as active as the one over there.
And the difference in this, if you look down into this tank, is that the steam coils are exposed down at the bottom, and we're looking down about probably about 20 to 25 feet before you hit the top of the liquid, whereas in the more active ones, it's probably about 6 feet, right?
Yeah, around there.
And this is just still being filled up, right?
This one's just being filled now. This one here was the last one that they filled, so it's about 6 hours old, and you can see it's very active. The reason for the headspace is quite often early in the in the fermentation, the viscosity isn't low enough in the fermenter and you need to leave enough room for foam.
Otherwise you have a mess.
On the floor.
Which is another reason for going to those closed top fermenters, right?
Yes.
And what you can't see is that we're looking down through the steel grate floor here and actually looking down about probably 80 feet down to the actual surf floor in here. We're up on the upper levels looking down through the grating here. These tanks are just absolutely massive. Think of probably about an 80-foot deep hot tub, and that's what you're looking at here, and multiply it, the diameter of that about three times, and that's sort of the size and scale you're getting here. We're walking past the closed top fermenters here now into the other side of the cooking room.
So this is the top of the mash cookers, basically. So you see where the grain valves and grain conveyors and the agitator motors and all of that is. And you see part of that hardwood floor. Back in the day, this was polished, and it's not looking so good right now. But it's kind of interesting that somebody would build a distillery with a hardwood floor. At least it's interesting to me.
And it looks like an old high school gym floor almost in a lot of ways here. We've moved into master control, as it were.
Yeah, so this is the distillery control room, and it's basically like the bridge of the Enterprise. So the operator here has six computer monitors, and he uses those to look at various parts of the process at any time. The control room operator basically operates everything from grain handling through to distillation, and so he has various screens here for the various stills. He has some spreadsheets for production reports. He's got the batch still on and one of the mash cookers.
How many people do you have working on site now compared to when you started here?
When I started here, there were five operators per shift. Now we have two. So with the automation, there's been a certain amount of rationalization in terms of the number of people working.
Morning, Dave.
How are you doing?
Good.
I'm just checking up on you. Don't worry about it.
You got a bomb, 263, and a bomb, 263.
First step in distillation after 3 days in the fermenters is the beer still. A plate style beer still here where we inject preheated distiller's beer into the top. Distiller's beer is basically fermented mash, and we supply live steam to the bottom of the column. Because the alcohol is more volatile than the water grain mix, the alcohol concentrates in the top of the still, and then the grain and grain and water residue goes over to our drying plant to be processed into animal feed.
So the cows in Alberta are just as happy as the ones in Scotland, right?
Absolutely. So second step in distillation, and really Canadian whiskey is a little bit different. If you look at most Canadian whiskeys, most of them are blended. And what that means is it's a blend of base whiskeys, which don't have a lot of flavor, and flavoring whiskeys, which have a tremendous amount of flavor. And so we distill them both differently. So for base whiskey, the first step in the distillation process is extractive distillation. So any grain fermentation is going to have certain higher boiling alcohols in it that have a lot of flavor, but you don't necessarily want a lot of them in the final product. In a classic pot still, those would be removed in the tail cut, but for our base whiskey, what we do is we remove them in an extractive column. Basically, what it does is it concentrates those higher boiling alcohols in the top of the column where we draw them off, and then a somewhat dilute ethanol water mix is in the bottom of the column, and we send that to another column called a rectifier that basically removes the water.
Let's talk about the size of these stills for a second. These are, I think, what, 48 inch wide stills?
Yeah, this one here is actually 60. I think both of those are 60 inch. And the extractive column, I think, is 42 feet in height. The rectifying column is 60 feet.
How often do you have to replace those or get them repaired?
Well, they're stainless steel stills, so we do have a sacrificial copper section in the top of each still because you need a certain amount of copper in the vapor stream to prevent off odors in the spirit. So rather than have a copper still where the whole thing is subject to erosion, we have stainless steel stills that are very durable. Since I've been here, these have been repaired a few times, but the repairs have been relatively minor.
What would it take to replace one? You'd have to take the roof off and lower a new one in?
These are actually built in sections. So the last column that we replaced here is our batch rectifier, and they assembled it in place from the various sections. So I was talking about base whiskeys versus flavoring whiskeys. This fourth column here is a batch rectifier, and what we use it for is to produce base whiskeys of various flavoring profiles. So we can either have a sweeter front end on the whiskey or a heavier back end or more flavor overall, and by specifying to the operators the way to run the still and where the cut points are supposed to be, we can actually get that kind of product from the batch column. We also have Canada's largest pot still here. It's 75,000 liters, so it's a very large pot still. Doesn't look like a classic pot still. It's actually a horizontal cylinder with steam coils in it, but it has a large sacrificial copper section in the condenser.
A horizontal still? So, yeah, I got to see this.
So right back there in the back of the room, you can see the vapor line coming off, and it comes up this way. It goes up to the near the roof of this building where there's a sacrificial copper section and a condenser. Now, in a normal linarm style pot still, the shape of the neck and so on and so forth controls reflux, and of course you can control boil up rate and so on and so forth, product draw rate to a certain extent. This pot still is computer controlled, and we can actually control the boil up rate, the reflux rate, product draw rate, and so on, as well as the cut points, so that we can very, very effectively establish the flavor of the whiskey that we want to produce.
So in other words, you've got the pipes that connect it up to the condenser and coming out the top of this still, which basically looks like a large horizontal tank, and it comes out the top and then goes up.
Yeah. And then because we can control independently the boil up rate of the still as well as the product draw rate and the condenser pressure, because of those parameters, we're able to control the reflux rate, and that gives us a tremendous amount of control over the type of product that we can produce in the still.
And what would you use the pot still for, or the whiskeys for?
We use the pot still to produce our flavoring whiskeys. So as I said before, Canadian whiskey is a mix of blended of base whiskeys and flavoring whiskeys. We produce the flavoring whiskeys directly in the pot still.
So that would be mostly the barley grains. Which grains would you put in that one?
Rye, 100% rye in the case of our flavorings. Notwithstanding that, we do use the pot still to make custom distillations for other customers where they want to specify the grain bill. So today they're dumping, it looks like, base whiskey, and I'd have to go over there to find out just exactly what the age is. For base whiskeys, we reuse the whiskey barrels over and over again. For the flavoring whiskeys, we either buy one-stump bourbon barrels or brand new American oak barrels, depending upon the recipe that we're using.
How often will you reuse those barrels?
We'll reuse them until they're no good anymore, and then we sell them to Scotland and they use them. So here again, we've got the old and the new. We've got wood walls, wood ceiling, very old small tanks, and so on and so forth. We still use these for blending components, but the real business is done over here. So this is the new bulk loading and blending area. It's all computer controlled. All of the tanks are on weigh scales. So there's automated recipes that the operators enter into the control system that will open valves and start pumps and direct the flow to various places depending upon what they're doing. Each one of these tanks in this area is sufficient to load two bulk rail cars or up to 10 of the smaller sea containers that we saw out at the dock, depending upon what the product is. When we go out the door, let's move to the right quickly so we don't get run over. So they're loading the barrels onto the pallets out here, 26 barrels at a time. Straddle carrier will take them out to the warehouse where they're going to re-warehouse them. This is base Canadian whiskey, so the minimum age requirement is going to be 3 years.
And this would go into almost every product you make at some point, right?
All of the whiskey products, certainly, but then there are other products where we age to particular age claims, like, for example, Alberta Springs and Tangle Ridge are both 10-year-old. So there would be some of this put away for those products, but it wouldn't necessarily be put into these warehouses. It really depends upon what our forecast is for that age of product in a given year.
Now, for your customers, your outside customers, will you ship them barrels or will you ship them tanks?
It's generally bulk loaded tanks, so we'll do the blending and all of that here, and then it's ready to go into the container, and then it's sent by sea container. We have occasionally shipped barrels to customers, but it's relatively infrequent.
No pressure to find just the right key, right?
Yeah, it's always the last one. So this is one of the pallet houses here. We have 10 barrel warehouses, and that is the smell that lets you know you're alive and you're in a whiskey distillery. I absolutely love that.
Describe this smell for me, because this is just intense.
It's very, very strong, intense oakiness, but you also get little hints of vanilla and sometimes maple, depending upon the particular product and the age of the barrels. But you see, we have these very large fans in here to keep the air circulation. And because you have a much higher barrel density in a pallet house compared to a rack house, we use the fans to ensure that the maturation is similar from the top of the warehouse to the bottom.
Have you noticed any difference in maturation between the rick houses, the standard size rick houses, and the pallet houses?
As far as base whiskey is concerned, no, not really. And we haven't done anything around trying to mature flavoring whiskey in pallet houses, so I can't really comment on that.
Okay. And just for to sort of give you an idea of the scale here, we're looking at pallets that are stacked five high, probably going back about 20 pallets or 20 rows back of stacks of pallets. This warehouse is probably the length of a football field from where I'm looking to the other side, and there's no way to tell how far back it goes. It's about probably the width of a good-sized football field as well. How many barrels will you have in this one?
I'm afraid I don't know off the top of my head. I know that we have 500,000 barrels in age split among 10 warehouses, so it would have to be close to 50,000.
And the thing I noticed is that there's not a lot of ventilation letting outside air in. This is all pretty well closed off. I know, is that just to keep it consistent and keep it that way year-round?
Well, there's no heat in the warehouses except what's necessary to prevent the fire protection from freezing. So normally we would want to keep the doors closed in winter.
The other thing that I don't notice, you see at a lot of distilleries anywhere in the world, is the fungus, the black fungus.
Yeah, actually, we have that. If you look on the side of the stillhouse from, yeah, like, second building over from here, yeah, you can see it down the sides of the... And you'll see it on the walls of some of the warehouses.
The older ones.
Yeah, probably over here you'll see some.
I wonder if the cold sort of fights that a little bit during the winter and knocks it back.
We have the same distillery mold that everybody else has. It's, I don't know, maybe not as obvious, and it might be related to the dryness of the climate here. So we are also at 3,400 feet above sea level. We're in the foothills of the Rocky Mountains, and so it's kind of a unique climate.
And the humidity here is probably maybe 30% at most during the summer, right?
Very low.
How's your evaporation rate?
I can't really comment on specific numbers, but we have models that kind of forecast what it's going to be depending upon the age and style of whiskey.
I know the typical standard assumed is about 2% a year, but obviously in drier climates it's going to be just a little bit higher. These warehouses have giant doors that are about 16 feet tall, painted bright red. These are cinder block warehouses that are about 50 feet high, it looks like, 50 to 60 feet high. And this is a more traditional style rickhouse with it looks like older barrels, at least.
Really, I don't think the age of the barrels would be any different. In fact, you will find some new barrels in here because this is where we will have some flavoring whiskeys stored. These are, in fact, though, base whiskeys that we're looking at. So this is pretty typical of a rack house at Alberta Distillers. They're 9 racks high. Each rack is 52 barrels deep, I think. Yeah, just a minute. Yeah, 52 barrels deep per rack. And I have no idea how many racks are in here, but there's a lot.
It's another one of those that goes back about the length of a football field, I would think.
And there's really no way to see the end. It's way dark down there. But it's very similar in size to the pallet house that we were in.
Now, there are customer barrels in here. There are signs on some of the barrels. I will not give you the names to protect confidentiality. But they are allocated to, some of these are allocated for other companies as well. And I'm looking at this and I'm looking 3, 6, 9 barrels high going all the way up to the ceiling. I would not want to be down here on ground level if one of those top barrels came down.
So I didn't catch it earlier. You're saying that you do about 20 million liters of production here a year?
20 million liters on a pure alcohol basis. So when that's blended out at bottle strength, it's somewhere a little north of 5.5 million cases.
So the last time I really did a piece on Alberta Distillers was back in 2006 when Jim Rogerson was in this role. And you guys had just gotten the award from Jim Murray for Alberta Premium 25. What was the mood around here when you found out about that? Because I would imagine for a distillery that produces 80%, as you said, bulk, to get an award like that or to be honored like that must have been pretty exciting around here.
So we were very pleased about that. And actually, the Alberta Premium family of products has been well recognized by Jim Murray over the years. So Alberta Premium 6-year-old has been his Canadian Whiskey of the Year a few times. He recognized the 25-year-old, as you said, and also the, I believe it was 2 or 3 years ago, I'm sorry, my memory escapes me, we had a limited release of Alberta Premium 30-year-old that was also very well recognized.
I have tasted both the regular Alberta Premium and the 25-year-old, and I shared Jim's comments on the 25. That was an outstanding whiskey. And the 6-year-old, I've still got bottles of that at home as well. Could you guys make more of that? That's really a marketing and distribution question. That's not a question for you guys, but that's never been exported outside of Canada.
It's always been in Canada.
Has there ever been a thought about hopefully maybe getting that outside of Canada one of these days?
You know, I really don't know how much traction that has. I've introduced the whiskey to some of my American counterparts, and they all love it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, really that is a marketing thing, and I can't really comment on it.
We'll hammer on the guys at Beam down in Deerfield, Illinois, and encourage them to try to make some Alberta Premium available outside of Canada. Now, walking back towards the main distillery section, and there's a big rack full of barrel staves and ends and everything. Do you guys have a cooper on site if you need one? Or
no, we don't, actually. If we have a barrel that is a leak, what we do is we send it off to a cull pile, and then when they have time and manpower available, they knock it down to staves, ends, and hoops, and they send it to a cooper in Scotland. And I wasn't kidding, actually, they do re-cooper them in Scotland and then start to use them for Scotch whiskey.
Where do you source your barrels from down in the States?
Well, because we're a Beam company, we deal with Beam for our used barrel supply. For new barrels, of course, we deal with Beam suppliers.
Mostly guys like Independent Stave and folks like that?
Yeah.
The usual suspects in that there are not a lot of coopers that can make this quantity of barrels.
No, I don't think so. You know, I don't really have a lot of involvement in the barrel side, so I can't really comment on that.
I got to admit, I'm impressed with this straddle loader. What this thing is, if you've never seen one, and I'd never seen one until today, it's basically a U-shaped forklift that with a space in it that's about probably 12 to 15 feet wide. And what it does is drive over this 30-foot-long pallet with barrels on it, and then reach down and clamp onto those barrels, lifts them up, and then lifts them up from underneath so that you get a good balance on the barrels, unlike a forklift, which can possibly get front heavy, and you can only carry a few barrels. You're able to carry 26 barrels at a time on this, and really makes it more efficient, although I've got to figure it probably doesn't go real well in the snow.
Actually, it does just fine, but we have a fairly extensive snow removal program and paved roads between all the warehouses and so on. So. Okay.
Because this is the only distillery I've seen that does that, or has one of these.
Yeah, as far as I'm aware, that's unique.
What do you think about when you come in here to work every morning? Because you can see the steam coming off from blocks away, or literally from a couple of miles away as you're driving in towards here. This is on the southeast end of Calgary in the more industrial section.
Actually, that's true. I do look for the steam because then I know that the distillery's running and I'm probably going to have a fairly smooth day.
If it's not running, somebody's already called you, right?
Well, yeah, I'm generally aware of what's going on.
So this is quality assurance at Alberta Distillers. So we have a couple of gas chromatographs here. We have a variety of instruments that they use for quality for grains and so on and so forth. We do GC analysis, gas chromatograph analysis of all of the intermediate distillation products as well as end products and so on and so forth. But the truth of it is the actual pass or fail on quality really depends upon the taste and smell of the product. And so we have trained taste panelists to check basically every product before it's shipped to ensure that it conforms to specifications.
There's only so much the equipment can tell you, right?
Well, actually, certain compounds, your nose is way more sensitive than a gas chromatograph.
Explain that, because I know that the nose is far more sensitive, but one would think that a gas chromatograph would be able to pick up stuff that the nose wouldn't be able, or we wouldn't be able to, we would not be able to decipher on our own, right?
Well, it can tell you sometimes what the component is, but in terms of the actual smell and the impact to taste, I think your nose is actually better for that. So one example is diacetyl, which has a smooth, buttery sort of flavor. Our vodka products contain a little bit of it, but it's below the detection limit of our gas chromatograph, which can detect down to parts per million. However, people are able to pick up that aroma from the taste panels.
How closely do your folks work here with the Global Innovation Center lab down in Claremont, Kentucky, that Beam runs? We were down there earlier this year for a tour and saw the
extensive lab down there. How closely do your scientists work with them?
Well, they do projects together in terms of matching customer samples. They also do. I've worked with the whiskey innovation team to bring other ideas and new thinking across the whiskey categories. So in Beam, we have folks who distill bourbon, we have folks who distill Canadian and rum and all of that. There are certain commonalities and there are certain differences, and every once in a while we get together to kind of brainstorm ideas on how to do everything a little better or find new innovative ways to do things. So the things that we do know that we evaluate regularly every day are new distillates. So this particular glass is the batch whiskey that we made yesterday. And you can see very clear color. This is going to have a very neutral character. And in fact, it's almost vodka-like.
So I'm getting the really neutral, little bit of wheat on there, a little bit of straw, grass, the dried flowers like you'd expect to get from a wheat.
Yeah, but still a very neutral distillation. And a minimum of 3 years and up to, who knows, years from now, that will be Canadian whiskey.
So what's the oldest barrel you have on site?
I'm not really certain, but I suspect we must have some in the 20-year range, but I don't know that for sure.
And that Alberta Premium 30-year-old can never be repeated, probably, right?
No, we had only 700 cases of that, and it sold out in the first weekend that it was released.
And Andrew is here, Andrew Ferguson from Kensington Wine Market. And first of all, thank you for helping to arrange this. But how much of that 30 did you guys wind up selling?
We had a couple hundred bottles, and it disappeared almost instantly. So, yeah.
Did you keep one for yourself?
Oh, yeah, of course. Well, you got the inside track, Mark. You don't let that go.
We're going back outside now. Now we're going up into the packaging department and bottling hall area.
So the packaging department is governed by GMP HACCP regs, which means that we have to wear hair nets, and I think we're probably okay on the facial hair, so maybe not beard nets, but jewelry has to be covered by gloves and so on and so forth. Okay?
I think this may actually be the first time I have ever worn a hairnet. My grandmother used to wear these all the time, but... Yeah. No, I can guarantee it wasn't for the same reason. My grandmother was a deep-dip Southern Baptist teetotaler who would be mortified if she knew what her grandson was doing for a living these days.
So, this is packaging at Alberta Distillers. Basically, what gets packaged here is our domestic production. And currently we're at about 700,000 cases, roughly 20% of our total output from this plant gets packaged here, and that's exclusively for the Canadian market.
Has that grown over the years? I know that Canadian whiskey has really been one of the bright spots in terms of the entire whiskey industry in terms of growth.
The actual product mix has changed over the years, but the total production has remained relatively static.
It's gone to more premium stuff, right?
Well, you know, what you find, it really varies with the economy. So if the economy is good, you'll sell lots of 10-year-old and 20-year-old when it's available and those types of things. When the economy is bad, you're still going to sell products, but it'll be more 3-year-old, 5-year-old, that type of thing.
Now, do you only bottle the whiskeys that are made here, or could you bottle for your corporate counterparts at Canadian Club if they shipped tankers out here?
Currently, this packaging department runs at capacity, so we wouldn't be taking on additional packaging projects from that. But basically, what we're restricted to right now is our domestic production for Alberta Distillers brands. What we're bottling here today is the 175 size of Alberta Pure Vodka. So this is actually the original bottling hall from when the distillery was built. And you see more of the same hardwood floors and all of that. This one here is actually covered with linoleum now, but when I first started here, this was still a hardwood floor. But
The funny part of it is, of course, all of the equipment has been updated over the years, so you see relatively modern packaging machinery. It's all computer controlled and so on. But the one throwback to the old days is that we still hand package here. And the reason that we hand pack is that it gives one set of eyes on the bottle before it goes to the customer to make sure that everything is right.
One final set of quality control just to make sure all the labels are straight, all the everything's right, the fill levels are all right, and that the computer didn't screw up, right?
Basically, yeah.
Because as we all know, computers do occasionally make a mistake.
Especially in my hands.
We're walking up over the line now on one of the catwalks.
So we have two lines here, and they're almost identical, except that the one on this side has a pressure-sensitive labeler in addition to the paper and glue labeler. And the what they do is they'll be setting up this line, which is what these folks are working on, while they're operating the one on this side. And then when this production run is done, they'll start up this line and then set up that one for the next production.
And these are all designed for large production runs, pretty much, right?
Well, we try to maximize that, but of course with some SKUs, the sales don't justify the inventory that would require, so it's a delicate balancing act.
And we've stepped out the back end of the bottling hall over to the catwalk overlooking the loading dock, where all the product eventually winds up going out to distributors all over Canada, right?
Basically, yeah. And then the other thing we see from here is our cull barrel pile, and those aren't all culls, so sometimes during certain parts of the year we actually fill whiskey faster than we ship it to customers, and sometimes the opposite's true. So the barrel pile will either grow or shrink depending upon what customer requirements are at the time.
Let's talk about the neighborhood here. This sort of was the industrial part of Calgary originally that, as you mentioned, was grew up, the city sort of grew up around this, right?
Yeah, basically. So originally back in 1946, there was nothing but farmland to the south and east of us, and it was all predominantly rye farms. That was the reason for founding the distillery on this site. But if you look off to the west, a little bit to the north, and to the east of us here, what you see is a large industry. So there's a flour mill there, a very large flour mill owned by ADM. That is a very large malt house owned by Canada Malting. And so they basically provide malted barley a little bit to us, but largely to breweries and customers in Canada, but also customers in Asia as well.
And you can't talk about Calgary right now without discussing the flooding earlier this year along the Bow River and the Elbow River that run right through downtown Calgary. I know, as we reported this summer, that you guys didn't have any issues out here because this is up on a higher level away from the distillery, but the distillery was still closed for a few days, right?
Yeah, the distillery, we were under an evacuation order because the city had to close all the bridges leading in and out of this area. So you can't get to the distillery site without crossing the river somewhere. And as a result of them having to close the bridges, we were unable to access the distillery for 3 days. Notwithstanding that, though, the high water mark from the flood actually ended up about two blocks away from here. So this street here is 14A Street, and the high water mark was two streets over that way at 16th Street.
How were your workers? Anybody have any problems?
Some of them, unfortunately, lived in areas where there were substantial flooding and damage to their property. It's very unfortunate.
But closing the distillery helped them also to be able to at least take care of their own issues, right?
Well, hopefully it did, yes.
Two blocks away, and we are significantly on a higher level, which sort of gives you the idea of just how much water actually hit when these rivers flooded. Andrew was driving me through downtown Calgary yesterday, and we saw places where the water was, the high water marks were well above my head and Andrew's head, and we're both well over 6 feet tall, and it's just unbelievable how much water came into here.
Yeah, it was really surprising. I've never seen anything like that, and hopefully I don't get an opportunity to see it again.
The distillery is not open to the public for tours, even though Rick makes a pretty good tour guide. By the way, you'll find a photo of that straddle loader in action at WhiskeyCast.com. And that's this week's WhiskeyCast In Depth. Let's start off the What I'm Tasting This Week department with one of the whiskeys we talked about with Rick during the tour. The Alberta Premium Dark Horse won a silver medal in the 2012 Canadian Whiskey Awards, It's a blend of two different rye whiskeys with corn whiskey and just a little bit of sherry, and bottled at 45% ABV. The nose has hints of juniper, sawdust, toffee, creme brulee, and maple syrup. And the taste starts off sweet, followed by a good burst of cinnamon that fades to reveal grapefruit and ginger notes, balanced by a charcoal ashiness and a touch of molasses. It's a very complex palate. The finish is long and smooth with fading spices and a hint of raisins. I'm scoring Alberta Premium Dark Horse an 85. The Celtic Whiskey Shop in Dublin has released three new single cask bottlings under its own Celtic cask label. I had the chance to taste them while I was in Ireland during September as they were being bottled. Celtic Cask number 3 is a single grain Irish whiskey distilled at Cooley back in 2001 and finished in Anima Negro red wine casks from Mallorca. It's bottled at 46% ABV. The nose has notes of red grapes, raspberries, ginger, and a slight nuttiness. The taste is fruity and full-bodied with fresh berries at first, and a good cinnamon punch that builds up slowly and lasts for a while, fading into a finish with a note of cherry pie and hints of cinnamon and graham cracker pie crust. This one shows just how complex a single-grain whiskey can be. I'm scoring Celtic Cask number 3 from the Celtic Whiskey Shop a 92. By the way, Celtic Cask number 4 is a Cooley unpeated single malt, finished in Madeira wine casks. Celtic Cask number 5 is a single pot still whiskey from an undisclosed distillery. And finally, White & Mackay's Fettercairn Distillery has produced some interesting older expressions recently. I got to taste the Fettercairn 24 and 30-year-old malts last weekend in Calgary. Let's focus on the 24-year-old. It's bottled at 44.4% ABV. The nose starts off with notes of honey and vanilla, followed by allspice, ginger, and cinnamon spices, with brown sugar and molasses in the background. The taste is syrupy and smooth at first, with a peppery bite that develops and takes over, with subtle touches of clove and allspice underneath. The finish is short, with a lingering touch of clove that sticks to your tongue. I'm scoring the Fettercairn 24-year-old a 92. I've added these tasting notes to the searchable list of more than 1,000 different whiskeys at WhiskeyCast.com. That's also where you'll find links for WhiskeyCast HD and WhiskeyCast Virtual Tastings episodes, the calendar of events, the latest whiskey news, my photo gallery, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is WhiskeyCast.com. You can follow me on Twitter at WhiskeyCast and on Facebook, too. My email address for your questions and suggestions is comments@whiskeycast.com.
WhiskeyCast. Proudly brought to you by Redbreast. The definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Join the stillhouse at singlepotstill.com and receive an exclusive whiskey tasting journal.
WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2013. And comes to you each week from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.